Welcome to another episode of Foolproof Theology. It's great to be with you here again today. My name is Chase Davis, and I am your host. Today on the show, we are going to talk about history, specifically Colorado history. Now, some of you may be tuning out right now. You're like, I'm not in Colorado. I don't care about it. It's too blue. I care about Colorado. I am here. I'm a pastor here. I'm actually in my office right now, and you may hear some preschool noises coming from down below where they have the preschool that I office above here in Boulder, Colorado. I think this is an important topic, and I'm happy to get into it here with Reverend Dr. Adam Kuntz. Adam, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
So you're down at Trinity Lutheran Church in Denver. You just moved to the Denver area, what, about a year ago? Is that right?
Yeah, going on two here, but back in 2022. And, you know, we can talk about some of the differences between Denver and Boulder, but for outsiders, they're not going to be that great, so I don't want to bore them.
Sure.
We're all pretty strange here, up and down the Front Range.
That's right. Yeah. And then you're a doctor, so you got your PhD, it looks like, at Temple University. What was your dissertation about out at Temple University?
Yeah, what I wrote about was when Paul tells people to imitate him, why does he do that, and what is he asking them for? And I did that coming out of church planting there in Pennsylvania and trying to figure out what we had an established church, we were starting a new church, what do we need to convey, what has to get passed on. In order for this actually to work and for this to be a Christian congregation. So that's how I got into the question. That's what I wrote about.
That's excellent. And is that published anywhere, or is it just kind of in some archives at Temple University?
Yeah, right. We're going for it. I'm currently writing. We have a publishing company here down in this part of the Front Range called Ad Crucem. And they asked me to write a commentary for families on the Bible. And that's what I'm working on. The first volume just came out on Gospels through Acts. Once that's done, I'll worry about publishing the dissertation. But
yeah,
that'll Understood. Come later. We'll worry about that some other time. Yeah.
That's great. So you were a church planter out in, I think you said Pennsylvania. Were you a Lutheran church planter at that church plant?
Yeah. So that's, I did that after I graduated from seminary. And, you know, we can talk a little bit about Lutheranism, but we have a pretty tightly controlled system. So I couldn't really, you know, being only 37 right now, I wouldn't really have time to have planted a totally different kind of a church and then already be a Missouri Synod pastor. So that all came after seminary. And yeah, so.
That makes sense. You know, I think from what I recall, and hopefully I'm not doing a disservice to any of my podcast guests. I don't think I've had a Lutheran on the podcast before. Just some of my background, so you know, is like I grew up Southern Baptist. We planted a church, non-denominational, but affiliated with Acts 29, still practicing Baptists. And in Acts 29, I got exposed to Presbyterians. I don't believe there were any Anglicans. I think there were Pentecostals. And at Denver Seminary, it's pretty much non-denominational, although back in the day, it was called the Conservative Baptist Theological Seminary, Conservative Baptist. But they dropped that, and that's what happens. You get what you get today there. That's not the point of this episode, though. But there, I encountered Methodists, Anglicans, a lot of non-denoms, some Baptists, community church people. I don't think I ever got a lot of airtime with Lutherans. And so we studied Lutheranism and the Lutherans because it's just one of the streams. But as far as I know, y'all trace your history back to Martin Luther himself. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. And I would say specifically my version of Lutheranism, which is the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, we're tracing it back to, really the Book of Concord. So all Lutherans are going to claim Martin Luther as some kind of authorizing figure. That's very different from what we would call being confessionally Lutheran, which is what the Missouri Synod is. Where we're using the creeds and Reformation era confessions of our own, the Augsburg Confession being the main one, to norm what's happening in the church. And because of that pretty high doctrinal standard, that's why you're not going to run into Lutherans at a Denver seminary, because whether this is good or bad in every way, that's going to isolate us because we educate our own, and you have to go through that system in order to be one of our pastors.
Okay. Wow. Yeah, I didn't know that. So pretty high control. Pros and cons to that, but can be a lot of cons, especially in our day and age. It seems to me, you know, that from what I can tell, there's kind of two camps. You mentioned the Missouri one.
Yeah.
I'm assuming there's another one that's liberal. Tell me about that.
Yeah, the other one that's liberal is called the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, and that that actually includes we had a battle for the Bible kind of a thing, like the Southern Baptist Convention in the 70s. And our folks that left were some of the drivers in forming what's now the ELCA that got going in 1988 and brings together a couple different streams of immigration at different times in American history with kind of the Missouri Synod's wildest, most liberal people. And that's the ELCA. And so that's really had its own momentum since 1988, whereas the Missouri Synod is a lot in this way, like the Southern Baptist Convention, that we went in a great direction at a time when everyone else was going in the wrong direction. And we're trying to figure out what that means in 2023.
Okay. Gotcha. So help me understand. I know these are really rudimentary questions. I appreciate your patience. why is it called Missouri Synod? Founded in Missouri, or what is that about?
It's because Missouri is where, Adam and Eve were in the Garden of Eden and right. So it's weird. Like there's this weird parallel thing where we run parallel to Mormons for a while, but you know, it's weird. Anyway, no, it's because a synod is like, that's what happens every 3 years where we all come together like a convention in other churches. And Missouri is where most of this has always been headquartered in and around the city of St. Louis. So we have a seminary there. That's where our publisher is and so on. Yeah. So that's why Missouri, but I never explain Synod unless I absolutely have to, because people usually say Synod and they don't even know what that is and it doesn't really matter, but yeah.
That's great. And last question on this topic would be like, I'm assuming a lot of the people at your church at Trinity would be people that grew up Lutheran. Do you get people that are coming to the church maybe for the first time? And what does that look like for somebody that's not Lutheran to join a Lutheran church? If you've got a pretty high control system, do they have to jump through a lot of hoops to become a member? Or what does that look like?
Yeah, I didn't grow up. I didn't grow up anything. So I didn't grow up Lutheran. And the service, I think, is kind of the biggest initial barrier because it is liturgical and formal and anchored around our understanding of what's going on in the sacraments. And so that's going to govern how people behave and the kind of stuff that we sing and all that kind of thing. That's probably the biggest initial barrier. As far as teaching for membership and stuff, we don't have, for instance, really a difference between what the pastor has to believe and what the member has to believe. So that's, we have a pretty high doctrinal barrier. We have a pretty high liturgical barrier. Honestly, with people that don't grow up Lutheran, which is most of our new folks here at Trinity, just because of, and we'll talk about Colorado, just because of the way Denver is, that's actually been great because we ask quite a bit and therefore we get quite a bit, right? It's not kind of easy in, but therefore it's also not really easy out. So doctrinally and liturgically, I think that works very well, because we're like, hey, you need to pay attention and here's how this fits together with what happened last week. And this is how this fits together with this traditional understanding of this creed that we're saying together. And I think it works great, but it does look really weird if you've just been driving around looking at billboards and looking at your phone and stuff. And then you walk in here and it's like, what are these words from, you know, the fourth century?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's been fun at our church to try to incorporate more of the Apostles' Creed. Our church just adopted the 1689 Baptist Confession, just trying to lean in to our tradition a little bit more and own it.
Right.
And so now we're trying to like bootstrap, okay, what does it look like to then teach people about that, you know, and not just have it sitting on the bookshelf, but use it because it's really helpful.
Yeah.
And so I love history. That's, you know, what I'm getting my PhD in is historical theology, but particularly Colorado history, it's always confused me because I grew up in Texas. Obviously I have the Texas flag. If you're watching on YouTube, you can see it. And so like, you know, I'm proud of my heritage, and my sons are growing up raised by two Texans in Colorado. They think Texan is like an ethnicity. And so, it kind of is. But when I came to Colorado, I was like, what's this place about? Like, I've always come up here. I've come up here my whole life. Every summer I've skied up here, and just like a good Texan would. And I come up here, and, you know, when I landed here in Boulder to plan, I was like, so what's the history of the town? What's the culture like? Because a lot of times when you're planning a church, you want to, it's not that you cater to the culture, but you want to understand what are the cultural idols, or what are the narratives, what are the stories people are telling. And what I discovered was it's just not a lot. It was just kind of like, it was like grasping at straws. And then when back in the day when I would listen to NPR, which I don't anymore, but I would just try to understand, it's CPR up here, Colorado Public Radio.
Right.
You know, I was listening to them talk about our history as a state. And I was like, okay, cool, tell me about it. And they were like trying to figure out what artifact from history should be celebrated in this new memorial or museum as like the featured thing that tells our story.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh yeah, what would that be? Would it be mining? And they were like, we're going to get some sandals from the Sand Creek Massacre from the Indians that were killed there. And I was like, that's a complicated historical event. You know, the killing of children is bad. And that's an odd thing to kind of put front and center. And you see that in Boulder. You see that with the renaming of one of the mountains. I can't remember which one. I don't think it's Pikes. I think they're trying to rename Pikes Peak.
Is Mount Blue Sky now. Yeah.
Yeah, Mount Blue Sky. So they're trying to do this, and they've been trying to do it, and they're very effective at it because most people here don't care because they don't know their own history. And so I listened to your episode on A Brief History of Power. I'll put a link to that in the show notes for the listener. And you'll get a more expansive version of what we're going to talk about. It's titled 168, Cities of the Mountains and Plains. And so what I wanted you to share is kind of like what you had kind of, being out here, you're getting to know Colorado, you know, what's Colorado's history? Tell us about it. This is going to be for church planners, pastors, lay people in my church, just to learn more about like, what are we facing here when we're trying to preach the gospel and minister to people? What are we facing culturally? So what's kind of some of the history that you looked into?
Yeah, and this is a good thing to do, like you said, even if you have nothing to do with Colorado, that you would be able to do things like this where you are so that you can understand who you're dealing with and what they're going to face. I would say, for example, something that's going to come up over and over again in Colorado's history, which is that people are in and out. It's transient, and therefore people and things and institutions are transitory. That drives a lot of loneliness that I didn't see in my first call in Pennsylvania, because people were they had the same names as the people that had settled that county, you know, in 1710. So you're dealing with it. You have very different spiritual problems based on the culture, the history, and people's grasp of it or lack of a grasp of it. So I think maybe the first thing to go into is a fact that if you look enough up about different parts of the West, but including Colorado, is that Colorado really has any significant settlement because of the 1859 Pikes Peak gold rush. It's a little misleading. Pikes Peak is down in Colorado Springs. The gold rush was really more in the Denver area here, first in what's now Denver and then in the mountains west of Denver. They call it Pikes Peak because people from other places had no idea really what they were looking at or talking about. So they were like, well, that's out there. So it's the Pikes Peak region, right? Okay. And that tells you that Colorado, for most of its history, was just distant from everything. The people that did come here were coming here to get rich. The exceptions being a pretty small Indian population and an even smaller Hispanic population way down in southern Colorado that had come up from New Mexico. And they were doing some of the same ranching and farming that they'd been doing in northern New Mexico. Those are both pretty small populations. The parts of Colorado that are what are called the Front Range, which is everything just east of the mountains, Denver, Colorado Springs, Boulder, Fort Collins, where the weather's kind of nicest for the whole state. It's kind of pleasant to live here. Nobody lived here in the whole scheme of things. Almost nobody lived here. And the reason being, it's kind of hostile to life. It's hostile to growing things, actually.
Yeah.
Like, it's a nice place to sit in the sun, or take a hike, it's not a nice place to grow things. So the people that were coming here basically to get rich. This happens right before the Civil War starts. 1859 is when we get going. And by 1861, the population is beginning to drop, so that by the 1870 census, which is Colorado's second really as anything that anyone's watching, the population is way lower than it was in 1860, because so many people had, they were called go backers. So many people had already left either to fight in the Civil War and or because they weren't getting rich, which is the way it always goes. So already there's this transitory nature to the state. That, and there's kind of other things we can track on a timeline here, but that's a theme that in Colorado is going to persist to the present day, is that if you meet somebody, not just who was born here, but whose parents were born here, you are meeting a very, very rare individual. I mean, it's almost kind of, and I have a child that was born earlier this year who is a Colorado native, whatever, she can have the bumper sticker someday. But it's really kind of sad that they need a sticker that says Colorado native, which if you come here, they've got, right? Or that there's no vacancy, is that it's like the people who are actually from here are kind of under assault. In the whole scheme of things, there weren't that many. So if you go back to 1960, you go back to 1970, the reason I can skip about 100 years ahead is because apart from some mining in the mountains, some logging, and honestly, all the parts of Colorado that look like Kansas, which people are surprised to discover when they come here. But there's like, if you're driving west toward the mountains, you got about 2 hours of basically Kansas, but with much higher taxes and more expensive fuel. Okay. That's where people actually lived. But there's really not that many of them. Maybe 2 million about 50 years ago. So we're looking at a situation where in the past half century, our population has doubled. That obviously is not natural growth. That's in migration from other states, from Texas, from the Midwest, and then most famously today from California. But what that's going to do is that it keeps Colorado in this kind of frontier-like situation where people are always in motion and they're ready to go somewhere else too. And that has a certain effect on the soul, that if you look at the history of any of the mining camps up in the mountains, you're going to see they'd have various ways to process the ore. They'd have saloons, they'd have brothels, and then eventually, maybe if it stuck around long enough, somebody would build a church building eventually.
Right.
But the church is always way behind the movement of the people. And that's true, I think, today, right? Is that, for instance, with just my denomination, and we can talk about church planting, just Front Range generally, but my denomination, 20 years ago, we had 4 more churches in the Denver area than we do today. I'd say maybe we're somewhere around 30 to 40 Lutheran Church Missouri Synod churches today, Denver area. The population of that area has doubled in that time. So we lost 4 churches cumulatively, and the population has doubled. Right? So we're in the same situation that we were in 1870, where we're trying to catch up with the miners and the people moving around, and they're thinking about getting rich. They're not thinking about their souls being saved.
Yeah. And one of the things that in all of that, kind of like a lot of people seem to have a basic disposition of very individualistic. I think a lot of this for the listeners, you can broaden it to the American context broadly, but like Adam was highlighting, each different state, each different municipality is going to be different. But for Colorado specifically, there's a spirituality of individualism, libertarianism that's very strong here. So maybe in Lutheran pastoring, you have more backing to say, well, we have high walls and we have high standards as a non-denominational church. And, you know, people have good reasons for this, okay? Not all non-denominational churches are that great. But when you say you should become a member of the church, it's good to be a member of the church. The church is the bride of Christ. How can you say you belong to the body of Christ when you don't belong to a body of Christ? And you start saying that to people in Boulder, and they're like, you're a cult. Like, you are, you know, whatever. Yeah. You know, they're very, suspicious of authority and institutions. And so that's been very hard. And so, like, even with our voting patterns, with marijuana, gambling, all these matters that come on the ballot, the basic instinct for a Coloradan, for someone who moves here, is like, well, it's freedom, you know? And, like, it's good. So we should let people live how they want. Right. So there's not really a history of enculturation from a moral standpoint. It's just like live and let live attitude. Would you say that's accurate?
I'd say it's very accurate. And because things remain transitory, or people do, there are things that, you know, in most other Western states, you think of the Wild West, and in the history of the Wild West, you're basically always dealing in the beginning with people being sort of insane, legal prostitution, and legal gambling. You just have to, everywhere used to be Las Vegas. Las Vegas is kind of a throwback in that way. If a place stays transitory, those forces of order in daily life that are going to say, let's not have legalized prostitution anymore. Let's not throw away most of our income on legalized gambling or, you know, sports betting at this point, right? Let's not do that. That's stupid. That's not a way to have a community. That gets shut down in your Idahos, your Arizonas, your whatever. And it gets shut down in Colorado for a little while too. But because you continue to have this in-migration of people who are here to cut ties, to pursue something that seems better, more interesting, more beautiful, more whatever, whatever it is that they come here looking for. Because of that, they're not going to vote in favor of let's regulate life more in a way that would be generally beneficial. They want to maximize personal choice. And so if at one time that seems maybe libertarian, functionally today that's going to be leftist.
Yeah.
But it's on this libertarian substrate. It's not on some sort of like Massachusetts style puritanism. Like, I know what's best for you. That's why we're, it's like, you should be allowed to do whatever you want.
Right. Yeah. And that's the transitory nature. I mean, what you just mentioned is really important. If you're ministering here, if you're just trying to build a community, for goodness sake, you know, the biggest need is the loneliness for a lot of people. I mean, obviously the biggest need is reconciliation with Jesus Christ, all of that. But I'm saying just like the tangible felt need that a lot of people have is this loneliness. But you're coming in and you've already moved here for a lot of people to cut ties, whether it's from the South. I get congregants that'll come from the South because they hated the stifling, you know, Christian culture, or they come from California. They've already decided to cut ties.
Yeah.
So that attitude of moving here, and I can even see that in my own when I uprooted our family up here. It was a lot of like, let's see what we can do. We can make a life for ourselves. Let's see how we can stand on our own 2 feet.
Yeah.
And that leads to a certain like way of pastoring people where you're going to have to address key matters. What about, because a lot of people, when they think of Colorado, they think of probably marijuana and they think of mountains and beauty. How does that play into kind of how you understand the history here?
Yeah, those both have to do, especially the beauty. And then later things like cannabis legalization, but it has predecessors in Colorado, you know, even when it was a very Republican state electorally, was not voting to restrict abortion, for example, and was fairly loose on divorce and stuff like that, is that it's a place to come to maximize your direct experience of significant things. It has nothing to do with other people. And so anything that's going to ask you to limit yourself, whether through divorce laws that don't permit no-fault divorce or whatever that might be, that just doesn't make sense to people because they're here to get an immediate experience. And in a theological sense, they're yearning for something that is actually tangible and is a productive starting point for discussion. Like, why do you so much prefer what you find in the mountains than what you live down here on the giant Denver metro area grid? You know, why are you always yearning to get back into the mountains when you've left them? Because you have a direct experience of the Creator that you don't and you can't in the suburbs. Okay. And Denver is not different from Dallas or Kansas City. In a lot of ways, it's different in the immediate access you have to stunning natural beauty. because of that, you know, I think in some ways people are relatively more open to having what they might talk about as spiritual discussions than they would be in a place where they have much less direct experience of nature, right? So there's something really beneficial about that. On the other hand, because everything is so direct and because they are here to be alone with those things and the sense of life that it gives them and the feelings that it creates in them, church is like, you know, fine. So I give you an example in the case of, you know, our people who already have some prior allegiance to the Missouri Synod, because if the viewers have no familiarity with Lutheranism, sometimes I explain it as being Missouri Synod Lutheran in a sociological way is basically like being Roman Catholic. It's the only kind of Christian you are, and it's the only kind you're ever going to be, because you are convinced that it's the only way to be a Christian. There's a lot of folks like that. So they're going to move here from Indiana, Michigan, Nebraska, and they know they're supposed to go to this church. So they do. But unlike in Indiana or Michigan or Nebraska, where they went every single Sunday, they'll come one Sunday out of four or one Sunday out of six because they're skiing or because they're hiking or because all of the reasons that they're here, that even though they know better, basically, they came here to be in something direct that isn't the kind of mediating, controlling institution that a congregation always is, because you can't do whatever you want. You got to go to church at a certain time. You got to talk to people. You know, it's not, you can't just do whatever you want.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
One thing that's been hard, I remember early on in church planning, is Texans get a lot of crap up here, and you know, for good reason, okay, for good reason. But I always joke, you know, well, if you want your ski town, your ski lifts to remain open, you should thank God for Texas, okay, because they come up here in droves and fund a lot of the stuff y'all like. But the other part is California. Up at, you know, University of Colorado here, we get a lot of people from California. Most of them don't darken the church door. It's kind of like a pattern. Like if you come from California, you go to CU, it's like there's already a certain light that's been chosen for you, believe it or not, and that you've chosen for yourself, that you're just not going to do that. But when during the height of COVID, I was listening to all the calls with public health locally, and they were always referencing San Francisco this, and I was like, no, I don't want Boulder to be San Francisco,
right?
And so talk to me about like the Californication of Colorado and what that means for us here.
Yeah, Californication is something that you can also see bumper stickers about here. Don't California my Colorado. It's too late. You know, it's too late. And what that means is that, you know, California has so many people. I mean, it's essentially like a mid-sized world power of a state. It's huge. 30 million people, maybe. I don't even know. It's huge. If they're going to pour out of somewhere, you can't really stop that unless you want internal passports, as another callback to COVID. Unless you want that, they're coming. And what they're bringing with them is something that I think Colorado was particularly not well set up to resist. And this is something that, you know, if you live in the Northeast or the Midwest or the Pacific Northwest, you're also familiar with, which is your substrate culture from a time when America was presumptively Christian, right? We can talk about church membership levels. We can talk about attendance levels. We can talk about Bible knowledge. I'm not talking about the Bible Belt. I'm talking about like the northern half of the country. San Francisco and Boulder were very similar in being settled largely by Yankees. Yankees had fights in the Congregationalist Church, in the Northern Baptist Church, in the Methodist Episcopal Church before it was the UMC, over the nature of Scripture, which always has effects in whether people go to church, whether they care, whether they know anything. And those fights in some cases were more than 100 years ago. So you're taking a place that's even more secularized than Boulder already was, and you're dumping people from that even more secularized place into Boulder, where the predominant form of religion, let's say in 1960, when Colorado had many fewer people, was probably already some soft version of liberal Protestantism. And you're infilling that with other religious influences, such as you get in California. But Boulder is one of the few places in the world that has a Buddhist university outside of like East Asia, Naropa. And in addition to that, you're getting the just ambient secularism of, I don't even know what churches are for. Like in the same sense that I, who don't ski, maybe that should change. But I, who don't ski, I don't go to ski shops. I don't know them. I don't go inside them. I wouldn't know what questions to ask. And for a lot of people who have been secularized for generations and generations, especially across the northern half of the United States, for a lot of people, that's how churches. They're not interested, and they have no idea why they should be.
Yeah, we encounter that a lot. I mean, even when Kim was working retail here in Boulder when we first moved here, and people were like, yeah. So your husband's a priest, so can you all like have sex? Or you're like, how does that work? You know, like they just have no concept of being a pastor. Unfortunately, a lot of the training I got in church planning didn't exactly help me understand how to deal with a lot of that well. And that's nobody's fault necessarily. It's just like, it's kind of the nature of American church planning, where the idea is you contextualize to the culture and you want to disenculturate as much as possible in order to reinculturate the gospel in a new culture. That's like the contextualization model. And I've written, listeners have written on that in several places. But what that set me up for was almost a deconstruction path, was where people would go like, what do you do? And I'd be like, I'm a spiritual teacher. And and I thought I needed nice. To like blend in, you know?
Yeah, right.
And like right. after 6 months of that, I was like, yeah. This is bunk. Like it doesn't help anybody, you know? It would be better for me to just own. I'm a pastor of a Christian church, you know, right. Really simple stuff. And then they go, what is that? And I can tell them just basic Christian stuff rather than kind of this contextualization model, which is like you're always playing the lowest common denominator
yeah.
of like you got to strip away everything that doesn't make sense to the culture in order to share the gospel with them, which is just crazy now that I think back on it. But what do you think about that? Have you experienced
yeah.
that?
Yeah. And the church planning training that I received, which was particular to my denomination, was not vastly different from what you just described. And the way that I try to think about it charitably is, because I know in this case it actually was, these models for church planning were developed in like maybe the 1980s, but probably earlier, actually, like 70s, 60s. And so when they're talking about culture and contextualization, they're thinking like, you know, Joan, right? Or think of some name that like a 63-year-old lady would have. You know, Joan doesn't go to church, but Joan was baptized and Joan probably had some Sunday school classes and she's asking the wrong questions and she's probably focused on herself. But, you know, if you kind of reach across the aisle and figure out how to talk to her in a way that's comprehensible to her, And there's a way in which, like on a human level, that just makes sense. That's you know, that's probably fine. But those models did not assume that the culture was, that Joan's like grandkids are transsexuals and Joan thinks it's fine now because her phone is telling her to. And so she's actually hostile now. She wasn't raised to be hostile. She's 63. Her kids are definitely more hostile and her grandkids probably think like you should burn at the stake. So church planning models just never, and certainly seminary training models broadly for parish pastors, just didn't assume hostility. They assumed kind of questioning neutrality at worst, and probably just deactivated Christianity that you, as you're contacting people, are just kind of starting back up, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's what I saw a lot of success in an older generation, like a mega church out here in Boulder County's Flatirons Church, huge church, yep. Big draw. And they take a lot of flack from the county for their stances because they do take a stance on biblical marriage. They're non-denominational, but they still have kind of that ethos of like, you know, we just want to like, I went to a service recently there and it was like, you know, maybe some of you have drifted away from church or maybe they're still trying to reach that demographic of people
right.
they, yeah. where there's, and for some people that works. I mean, for a lot of people, they go there and they call it bumping into Jesus or all this kind of stuff. And, you know, and this is not me hating on them, but I view that with a critical eye, but at the same time, like, I hope God bless, I hope people get saved there and all that. But my point is that was the model. That church, I think, was planted in the late 1990s, in Boulder. Yeah. It started in Boulder and then moved out to buy property to Lafayette. But yeah, it makes it really hard. So because church has always been a peripheral here and it's always followed booms and busts, what does it look like to build from that kind of conception of church?
Yeah, I think that understanding that this is a place that essentially never had anything like the cultural hegemony that the Southern Baptist Church did in the 80s in the Deep South, or the Roman Catholic Church had in, you know, Chicagoland in the 1950s or something. In a way, it's kind of helpful because you don't need to take the time to fight battles that are just gone, like legislative battles. Until you do a lot of work of gospel proclamation, none of that is going to change. So, like, don't worry about it, right? Arch conservative in Colorado means Lauren Boebert, you know, is divorcing her husband publicly. Like, that's the best we've got, right?
Yeah,
right. So we don't have people hypocritically pretending to be solid, you know, Christians in public life. So don't worry about that right now. Accepting that it's been peripheral means that you have to go back and do work that probably should have been done back when there was more of a cultural foothold. But it just wasn't happening, and that's okay. We didn't see it coming. We didn't anticipate this. So we're peripheral. That means, I think, that we should just accept that if we don't require high levels of commitment, we're not going to get anywhere. So a lot of not just church planting, but pastoral thinking and advice, and I think even the personality of a lot of pastors, all of it is designed to be absolute, like you said, lowest common denominator, easy entry. Like, it's basically rolling up to a fast food restaurant. We'll provide you with more or less whatever you want, and we're going to be as nice as we possibly can about it.
Right.
And I think that, you know, there's attitudinal things like, I don't apologize that if they show up on Trinity Sunday, which happens kind of early, you know, late spring, early summer in the Lutheran church, and we run through the Athanasian Creed, which takes a long time to say, and is, it says, if you don't hold to this, you will not be saved. I don't start out the sermon that Sunday being like, you know, this can come off as a little like weird to a lot of us, but here's why it's actually cool. You know, it's just like, this is what this is about. So I think that, understanding that you're peripheral means that you just give up on a lot of the moderating or bridge building that previous generations have invested in places like the South or the Midwest, because it seemed like it would have a lot more traction, and just say, this is what we're doing, and we're going to be as intense about it as the Buddhists are about, you know, meditating in public, in your public parks or whatever in Boulder.
Yeah. Yeah, which is always funny. Like, most of the Buddhists I encounter here, they're like nominal Buddhists, you know? It's like California Buddhists, where it's like, they just think it means be a nice person, which is what a lot of evangelicals reduce Christianity to also, you know, be a nice person. Right. It's very, very secular liberal of both of them, very American in that way. But in terms of like, how do we, if we were to imagine kind of a peripheral movement becoming central, because like, my heart is like, I would love to build institutions here that will last for generations, you know, plant seeds even. It doesn't have to be in my lifetime, but at least network people, connect pastors, connect Christians, build businesses, colleges, seminaries, schools, churches, all sorts of things here that can last. How does a peripheral movement then become more, if we want to call it centralized or whatever word we want to describe there, how does it move from the periphery?
Yeah. And I mean, it's not like there aren't examples of this. There just aren't really, in the past 50 years, Christian examples of this. So one thing you have to do is accept that you're operating on a longer timeline than a given human, if not even a life, at least a given human career. So if I'm going to be professionally active, let's say, between, if you're talking about a clergyman, between his mid-20s and his mid-60s, or maybe his early 70s, then you have to say, okay, I'm building, or I'm trying to build things that are going to be around when my grandson is a clergyman, or whatever the particular, it's a business, it's a church, it's whatever, is going on. That means that I don't think in terms of immediate return on investment of time or money or labor. If I'm building a business, I do need to get off the ground, but I don't need to be phenomenally successful. So just a couple different examples from Colorado that are not Christianity, but I think Christians would do well to think about and to learn a little bit more about. One that's really simple is that there didn't used to be a ski industry. People would go all the way to Europe to go skiing. Okay. And the reason there's a ski industry is because we had guys skiing around up in the mountains during World War II training to be sent to Europe. And then they're like, this would be a good place to have a ski industry. And they come back and they build it. It's not like right away in 1955, people are just flooding up from Texas to go skiing.
Right.
They have to build that up. They have to wait. They recognize the opportunity and then they wait to build it. And now, obviously, it's, if not world beating, it's certainly, we're the biggest thing there is in America as far as skiing goes. The example that's maybe a little bit more serious and definitely not as fun to talk about is that that basic libertarianism that we talked about is kind of baked into Colorado is really what gets weaponized by people who are not really libertarians. They're definitely not live and let live type people. Those are our out and out leftists, which Colorado is increasingly politically dominated by. Your average person is not that motivated. They probably are basically libertarian here. But the people who control our politics, for reasons that there's all kinds of history going on here, some of which involves campaign finance, kind of boring stuff, but it ends up being important. But what it means is that eventually, particularly through the town of Boulder, not just the university, but also the research institutions, public and private, that are around it, and then the companies that get spun off by a modern university and spun off by private and public research institutions. Because of that, if you have control of that, you basically have control of not only the mind, but also the pocketbook of the state. And that's really what changed, is that leftism saw the universities as absolutely key to taking over lots of other things in public life. And they carried that out in Colorado like they did basically everywhere else. Right. So before Boulder was a tech hub, Colorado was basically partly Midwestern and partly Southwestern in its economy. It was mostly agriculture and oil. And now we're kind of embarrassed by the oil. And, you know, the farmers are using way too much diesel fuel and way too much water to raise their sugar beets and their wheat. So the tech stuff feels clean. Right. So what's happening is that, like other places, but particularly in the city of Boulder, the left took over. And this is where, to me, the universities today, certainly in Colorado, are a lot like the monasteries at the time of the Reformation. They, if you don't really do something about them,
right,
nothing is ever going to change. Nothing.
Yeah. That's been one of the things I've been trying to tell people. Is like, it's a madrasa in Islam, where they train up their disciples.
Right.
The Department of Education here at CU, like what you see in the public schools in Denver and in other municipalities in Colorado, here in Boulder particularly, it starts there. They're teaching these young people the social justice slogans, the approving of transgenderism, all the queer stuff started at the Boulder Library here, started at the university. And then they send them out to then go make disciples. And they're very good at it. And that's getting back to the point of like, the team that wants to win is always going to beat the team that wants to be left alone. And so if Christians don't have kind of like a winning attitude, that doesn't mean you have to become a culture warrior. It doesn't mean you have to do crazy things necessarily, but it does mean like you have to, that's just reality. Like they're not going to leave you alone. They want your life. They want all of it.
Right,
and
right,
so like, yeah. what are we going to do about that? So what does it look like to like, maybe, what opportunities are there? I mean, you know, yeah. In a dark state of mind, one could go like, well, I'm going to be a subversive. I'm going to go to see you and I'm going to not be explicitly Christian and I'm going to rise to power and I'm going to get in power at CU and get tenured. Right. And then I'm going to get department head. And then I'll come out as it's kind of like that faithful presence model that many of us were taught about, where it's just like, oh, over the long term, maybe you can change the institution. So, but what does it look like today? Because if I were listening, I'm like, well, that's really depressing, Adam. Thanks for that very depressing kind of like story of Colorado. Problem. What are opportunities today for Colorado, for Christians here to like see things change?
So you have, I think, two different angles of approach. One is an inside the system strategy. And that one is always going to require more patience and is probably just going to be less successful. Okay. Because it's much harder to sneak into an enemy camp and take ground and then hold it than it is to maintain ground in a much larger group. So I think that there are Christians who believe in the faithful presence model. The problem is that the faithful presence model always assumed institutional neutrality. So they don't let you do that because they force you to make choices. They force you to perjure yourself in what you have to say to keep the job or even to get the job, or they're going to force you to assent to things that you don't assent to in church explicitly. So that your mind becomes, you become that kind of double-minded man that James talks about, who then is unsteady in all his ways. And you see that in people's lives all the time because they've been trained to be double-minded in order to both get paid and to go to church. So I'm pretty skeptical about that one because the left didn't face those odds when they took over these institutions. They were actually exploiting neutrality tipping into favorability to themselves, right? So back in the 80s, you had carve-outs for your assorted protected groups, racial, sexual, etc. Now, those carve-outs are just a lot bigger than they were, but they were still there. And you weren't going to get tenure because you were an overweight lesbian. Now you might. But back then, you weren't going to not get tenure because you were an overweight lesbian, right? So they moved into an environment of presumptive neutrality. That's very different than today. So I think outside the system is probably the way that you want to go. And this is where you look for the people and the opportunities that really are being overlooked by the way that our current regime operates. So you say, okay, we know whether it's just falling birth rates or whether it's COVID or whatever it is, we know that throughout Colorado, as throughout much of the nation, participation in public school is way down in all kinds of places, not just places that are conservative or that they're trying to, you know, whatever. Everybody
Yeah, even
wants
in Boulder.
Out.
Yeah.
Even in Boulder. Even yeah. in Boulder. And so you say, well, can I offer... We have a homeschool co-op at our church for that reason. Can we offer something and can people plug into that? That's one way. And I think schooling is probably the place to start. There are other, I think, channels we could talk about, but I think that's a place to start because there is pre-existent demand. And it's something that generally in hostile non-Christian cultures, that's how Christians start, is with schools. That's how they start.
Yeah.
Because people want their kids to know something, and you say, well, I can teach them something. And they're like, all right, you know. But that's the missionary strategy that generally they adopted when they went to China for the first time, or they went to wherever, you know, somewhere in Africa for the first time, Christians would start schools. So if we're in a hostile culture, and I don't want to stand around like I'm like Jerry Falwell appealing to cultural norms that don't exist anymore. I need to adopt some of the practices that Christians who went to obviously completely hostile cultures adopted.
Yeah. And I think it's fair to say, I mean, the kind of paradigm Ren puts out, the negative, positive, neutral world paradigm.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard when people are like, I don't believe that. And I'm like, I want to understand what you're saying, but it's like baffling to me being in Colorado because like everything is just so, I mean, the example I always give to people from Boulder is like when we're looking for a church building, first of all, like because we're explicitly Christian and Bible based, the liberal churches that are dying here, they're very much like one of them, like when our realtor called them up, so we wouldn't even have to deal with them. And it was very like innocuous. Somebody's looking to buy your building. And they literally said on the phone, if it's the Well Church, we'll never sell to them. They didn't even know it was about us. But that's the kind of like hostility we're talking about here. It's like there's that. And then if you try to buy a commercial property and if you were to try to flip it into a religious tax exempt property, the city would kill you through bureaucracy. That's never going to pass here. So you're looking at 50 to 100 religious exempt properties in Boulder, which is surrounded by greenbelt and mountains, where you're not going to be able to get a building here. And if a church planter is moving in here, the cost of rent of a public facility is so high. Not only that, but those public facilities are now very disinterested in hosting churches because of pressure from culture. You're talking about BVSD. One of the board members of BVSD said on Twitter, this church, the Well Church, is a hate group. You know, so like the idea that a Christian church is going to be planted in Boulder and meet a public school and that's going to go great. It's like, it's fantasy world. I mean, it's definitely hostile. But I'm like, why would I not want to be where the action is? Because like you said, and I don't know what, I always say this and I think it's right. And I'm not trying to be insulting, but like Boulder really shapes a lot of the state in terms of Denver because from us, like you talk about the transitory nature of just Colorado, but particularly Boulder, you get college students that if they're Christian, they start a family here, but then they can't afford to buy a home here, so they move to Denver. And so we're constantly exporting. And so what does it look like to be right at the heart of where the battle is and stand strong and be faithful? We don't have to make a show of ourselves. Like you said, we don't have to be Jerry Falwell or anything like that. But what does it look like to equip the church today? And I think that's where I take a lot of hope is like, man, there's maybe more cushy context. I don't know where those, I guess people say it's Florida or Texas, but I'm like, man, like I always wanted to, you know, go to where the action is to be following the Lord's lead. And God is doing a lot of work here. I mean, he's given us a building and it's going to be finished this spring. And we've planted a few churches and, you know, we're talking about starting Christian schools here. I mean, this is really exciting stuff. So I think it's really fun.
Yeah, and when you're talking about Boulder specifically, it's not just that they export pretty much everything, public school teachers, people that went to school there, people that in some way had their young adulthood there and then need to go somewhere else in order to have a house, whatever. It's that they lead the way that people who have never been there have to think about how things operate here. And so this is also something where when you're looking at a hostile culture, you have to think, where are the generation points for this network? There are lots of nodes everywhere, right? But where does the power get generated? Because if I know that, then I know where to target what I'm doing, right? So, I mean, Paul probably would, if he had learned some non-Greek languages, he might have been happier sitting up in the mountains of Asia Minor somewhere. I mean, in a way, it might have been certainly more pleasant life. The church fathers thought so, right? That's where they put the monasteries, which is where they would go when they got sort of old enough or distant enough from, you know, like in a way that would just be sort of nicer. In going to Ephesus, Paul is engaging with a site of power generation. And so he has to face Artemis of the Ephesians, and he has to challenge that's a mother cult. It's particularly opposed to Christianity. We have that in Mother Earth here in Colorado. So we have our own Artemis of the Ephesians that makes us great, and she is great. That's what we acclaim. Mm-hmm. And when you figure out that that's where the power is generated, then you know that, okay, if I attack this, then I'm going to get a lot more done than if I attack several smaller cults from places that aren't really connected to anywhere else, not in a big way.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm inspired. So thanks for turning the turning the podcast around from doom and gloom.
Good.
I have to ask with your podcast, A Brief History of Power, what made you want to start a podcast about power?
Yeah, it started, it's not really brief anymore. So it's basically a lie. It's a living lie. Cause it's like 3-4 years old. I don't know. We started in and around COVID just out of conversations between myself and another, Lutheran pastor, Jonathan Fisk, about why is this happening? Like, how did this happen? And, I kind of came out of a different context, having gone to a very left-wing liberal arts college. And so for me, COVID was like that college taking over the world explicitly.
That's funny.
Whereas he was like, what is going on? And so we were talking and then he was like, other people should hear this. And so that's how we started. And what we're interested in, and we talk about all kinds of stuff, but what we're mainly interested in is how do we understand what's actually happening and then provide some kind of wisdom or learn to obtain wisdom for the lives that we have to live now as Christians. Because we found that mainly our part of Christ Church was lacking was wisdom. We had good stuff on the books. We had good stuff in the past. How do we preserve that good stuff for the future? Well, I need wisdom for that. And that's what we didn't, how do we react? Do we keep our churches open? Can we serve the sacraments, right? Because those are very hands-on. I can't socially distance when I'm administering baptism. So that's why it started. And I think that's why it's still going.
That's great. Yeah. I mean, the topic of power is a fascinating one because a lot of people, when they hear me talk politically or talk about theology, you'll get words like theocrat or you just want power, all this kind of stuff. But I think that the evangelical church has done such a poor job of equipping it's just the broad population to think wisely about power. And because like, at least for me, like a lot of it was very pietistic, you know, you should never want power. If you have power, right, you should always give it away. I think some famous pastor said that one time. And so we're so like confused on like, well, what does it look like to have ambition? What does it look like to pursue influence and power? Because we've been taught for so long, it's a dirty word. You know, it's not good. And it's like, and then COVID hits and you're like, okay, I don't like that power. So maybe I should rethink how I think of it, you know?
Yeah, right. Exactly. And I think that in addition to having a doctrine of original sin that applies to you individually, you need to understand how that gets played out. And the Bible is great on this. I mean, particularly the Old Testament, which most Christians know nothing about, shows you how original sin plays out in families, in institutions, in a way that's actually productive for understanding what's happening around you. If you don't know that stuff, then it's really easy to kind of gaslight you into thinking the only sinner in the world that you need to ever think of or about is yourself.
Mm.
Right? I mean, it's pietism, but it's also just self-obsession, which is easy to sell to people because they have it anyway.
That's a great point.
You know,
I haven't made that connection before. That's a fantastic point that a lot of the pietism just is a perfect fit for a self-obsessed age.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And,
oh my
and it's
gosh.
Like, hey, how about you spend more time thinking about yourself? It's just kind of a depressed or self-flagellating version of being obsessed with yourself. Like you are by nature. Yeah.
Yeah. This is why I picked up the Valley of Vision. Have you ever read the Valley of Vision, the Puritan prayer book? And I prayed through it for a while, but it was in the middle of me kind of coming out of that pietistic self-obsession. And I was wrestling with, because they talk about themselves as like worms and stuff like that. But their self-conception is so radically different than our self-conception and self-obsession today. Yeah. It wasn't, to my knowledge, it wasn't born out of some, you know, self-obsession. It was theologically driven, and yet they would still build things and they would influence, they would start colonies and college, Harvard College. So like, that was a mind trip for me because I was reading it through kind of a very modern, liberal lens, you know, of self-obsession, individualism. But when you take them in their context, it's very biblical most of the time and, helpful. But you have to use the word disenculturate. You have to really like get away from the modern world as it's been given to you and as it's trained you, and that can be really hard.
Right. Yeah, I am a worm whose job is to glorify God, and worm that I am, I shall. Right.
That's right. That's good. Well, Adam, this wonderful conversation. I hope a lot of people listen to it, especially people that move to my city. I want this to be something that people in our church can listen to, share with other pastors. If people wanted to keep up with you, see what you're doing, obviously they could come visit Trinity Lutheran. Where else can they keep up with you? Are you on X or Twitter or anywhere else? Do you have a website?
I am not on X.com. I am a recovering Amishman or something, originally from Pennsylvania. So you can look up A Brief History of Power. We got 2 episodes a week. There's plenty to listen to there. And you can check out the Family Bible Commentary from Ed Crucham, and kind of get back into Scripture, I hope, in a big way. Through that. So just, and my last name is kind of distinctive, KOONTZ. If you Google any of that and attach Koontz to it, you'll find me.
Okay, excellent. Well, Adam, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Yeah, thank you.
Hey, if you're listening and you enjoyed this episode, I'd love it if you hit that subscribe button, give it a great rating, share with a friend. If you're here in Colorado locally, you have any questions for either Adam or I, just reach out to me and I'll either connect you with him or I'm happy to talk with you as well. Also, you can sign up on the Patreon. That helps me bring you great content like this conversation we had today. You can sign up there for $5 or $15. Get a little swag. You get early episode releases. So I love that support. I need that support from you. Patrons are great. Provide me feedback and guest prompts and show prompts. So go sign up there and we'll see you next time.